everyone, to a very special edition of my Fearless Media podcast. This is Peter Chadi of Creative Media. A couple weeks ago, I moderated a panel about AI, entertainment, and the creative arts, focusing on the real-world implications of generative AI on artists and on creativity in general. The goal was, sure, to discuss the business and legal implications of generative AI like ChatGPT and Midjourney, critical issues such as infringement or not for training AI on copyrighted works, and how the courts and regulators can even begin to wrap their minds around these mind-blowing issues. But even more than that, and especially this, to step back and really take a humanist view of how AI will impact the creative arts, including the role of human artists and what creativity ultimately even means. I intentionally chose a diverse panel of experts, representing first the artist and creative community. My guest here was Grammy-winning artist and film scorer Alex Ebert, who is also Edward Sharpe in the great band Edward Sharpe and the Magnetic Zeros. You definitely know the song Home. But I also wanted to feature a guest who is an AI artist and happens to double as a data scientist. And that was Faith Aya Umo, who I had first seen on a panel at a recent AILA event. My third guest also was a panelist at that same AILA event, and he straddles both worlds of AI and humanism. This was metaverse artist and educator Don Allen Stevenson III. And finally, my great co-host and resident AI legal expert was Mike Kasdan of the firm Wiggin & Dana. Mike is someone whom I've come to respect because he, like me, goes deep into all implications of generative AI, legal, business, and most especially, humanist. For this podcast, I skip the individual intros and get right into it, with my first question going to the creative artist, Alex Ebert, because human creativity is at the center of everything. It was a candid and frequently sparring discussion that showed real passion and emotion. I think you'll get a lot out of it. So enjoy. Alex, as an artist, how do you, when you first internalize this, just tell us your reaction and tell us the reaction that your fellow artists have had in your talks with them about what AI means for you as your art, for your art, your craft, and your career.
Well, first of all, I've been thinking a lot about, so I had my own personal reactions that were probably somewhat ego-based and whatnot, sort of the obvious things. For instance, there's an AI being developed to spit out scores based on mood prompts, whole scores for movies. And I'm scoring a movie right now, and I just got really amazing at scoring movies. I feel like I'm just getting to the place where I'm like, holy shit, like I'm Ennio Morricone part two. And then I find out that you enter a couple mood prompts and you can just get a score spit out to you. Now, the problem with that, If I had a sense of reliance on people's palates and tastes, this wouldn't be a problem for me. But unfortunately, I go over to my parents' house and they have Indiana Jones on TV. And I tell them, what's up with your television? Why does it all look like a weird, like rotoscoped 3D rendering of a bad video game on your television? They're like, what are you talking about? That's a classic. That's Indiana Jones. Like, you don't see what I'm talking about? Like, no, I'm like, let me see that remote. I grab the remote and I realize they have it set for HD sports, which is spitting out like a frame rate of like 2000 frames per second. Indiana Jones is 24 frames per second. So what you end up with is this weird animatronic thing that looks fake, but my parents didn't notice it. That's the problem that I have. If everyone's tastes were a little bit more attuned, there wouldn't be a problem because what I think spits out is going to be garbage because you'd be able to tell it's garbage. But the fact is most people can't tell. We have a lack of sort of like cultural nuance. We sort of think that that's lame and European and antiquated. So that's one aspect. Like if I thought people had some taste and they would be able to discern between one thing and the other, or when something just looks whack, that would be cool. But we live in a postmodern time where taste is completely relative. Beauty is completely relative. And that's cool. But the problem with that is that you end up with a situation in which democratization itself is the harbinger of homogenization. And that's, I think, what I'm most worried about. There's a very strange inverted relationship between democratization of taste and homogenization of output. And we see this when we started seeing foods being taste tested. And you start seeing like Nabisco, everyone starts making the same foods. And you see movies being audience tested. Now, all of a sudden, they have the Hollywood ending. Everything's being recut. The number of movies I've scored that came to me initially and were genius, and then they go back, audience test it, recut it based on a wide variety of people's opinions, and it comes back to me and it's shit. It's suddenly like every other movie you've ever seen, because the process of democratization actually leads to homogenization, because you end up with a mean opinion, a median opinion. And I'm afraid that that is just generally what's going to happen. I've definitely seen it happen with music. So I think my general sort of like, and I know this is a reactionary sort of conservative point of view, and I'm not like going along with the tech, but I'm just going to be that voice, I think, for this conversation, where I'm going to say, it's going to diminish the quality of our artistic output.
Let me ask you this, Alex, and then obviously this is the entire reason why I wanted this panel is to get a broad perspective, but it's very important to get more of the, you know, Alex and some of the people that you're dealing with. Have you had these kinds of conversations with other artists that you know?
For the most part, the people that I know that I've had these conversations with have the opposite opinion. Their opinion is, look, the calculator came and it disintermediated some of our like analog calculations, but it's still a human at the end of the day using a calculator, and we can just now do more and we can calculate more. But the problem is that when the scope of disintermediation, but when the scope of production is narrowed a couple degrees, it can be very liberating. But when you're reduced to simply a being that prompts, and then you realize at the end of the day, actually, Midjourney doesn't need you to prompt it. That's like a gimme that we're getting. Midjourney could very easily just scrape user sentiment across all platforms and spit out what it thinks we already want to see. Multiple iterations of it thinks what it thinks you want to see and I want to see. So basically, what we're getting this sense is like, we get to feel like we are the immaculate origins of a bunch of art, when in fact it's scraping all of this art. And essentially, you know, obviously this is the main conversation that goes on, is stealing this art from artists and then spitting it back out and giving the user a sense of immaculate origin, where they suddenly created this thing because of a prompt that they didn't even need to prompt. The GPT could tell you what you want to hear without you even having to put in inputs.
So let me put a pin in the scraping and the legal implications about that, because Mike, I want to get into that. But Aya and Don would love to get your perspective on what Alex was laying out.
Sure. So I just take a step back. I think, you know, everything that Alex says is valid, especially from a creator and in terms of thinking through how you're contributing and then also understanding the value of the results you get from like an AI model like ChatGPT. Personally, as a data scientist and, you know, going to different industries like foreign policy when I was at the State Department, and, you know, we brought AI for the first time. And a lot of times, I think in productivity, it's been seen as useful, which is different than creativity. And I found ChatGPT to be helpful in the productive, to be creative. So I see it more of co-creating. I don't see it as like, okay, I have this initial idea and then I give it to ChatGPT, and to take a step back, like my code is usually like, I'm using multiple models to create a concept. So it's not exactly just going to this one-stop shop to get your results. I think it's really how things are created and how you're co-creating with AI is where I think the value is, versus like, you know, kind of like a microwave solution, which sometimes feels like ChatGPT when you're creating results, like the example that Alex shared.
Aya, can I ask you a follow-up on that? Because you're a data scientist, but you're also an AI artist. So can you just take us through the process of how you create your art leveraging AI?
Sure. So this started out in 2021 when I got a Stanford grant. And I was looking, and it wasn't initially to be an artist. Like, it was really looking at the intersection of artificial intelligence, natural language processing, which is the ability to derive insights from natural text, and then also Afrofuturism. So I wanted to really just look at the intersections of, can I co-create with AI to make imagery that was more positive and more, you know, really pushing minority experiences in a similar light as the Black Panther. So it was purely in that creation mindset. And the first step I did was I took the book Binti, because that was my inspiration, and I passed it through my model. So I basically converted that book to, it goes from like text to numbers so the model can understand it. And I use it as a discovery tool. So I really just wanted to understand in this book, what are the main topics? And then where within that book do you find those topics? Like, what part of the story, what part of the scene? So again, this is mainly like my discovery tool. And so once I have the information, I would say that's where I would insert like my artistic input when I like look through the results to identify my collection, what do I actually want it to look like? What do I want to create from it? And then from there, I chose, I think, about five different scenes and then five different topics and a few different scenes from that topic. And then that's when I pass it through the generative model. And so in general, you know, this is a full collection that, like, I call this more of a co-creative pipeline. And two of those pieces were actually exhibited in Art Basel. And now we flash forward to 2023, I'm taking it an even step further, where I'm actually working right now with a producer and we're co-creating with AI, but it's more of making a immersive, interactive music experience. So this is in person. This is you, like, you know, similar to Van Gogh, but I would say better because it's interactive and you're getting to like co-create with AI. So to me, it's like, I want to really approach AI from that approach of like, oh, cool, like we did this together, but it's not necessarily, you know, on the lines of what Alex shared, which I think are very valid points of, you know, one-stop shop results or, you know, not really putting any effort into the overall output versus like fully leaning on like a black box model.
So Don, I want to bring you into this too. So you've heard the perspectives of Aya and Alex, and why don't you give your own views on some of the issues raised, including the kind of this, the lack of nuance and, you know, the artist's point of, with the inputs, homogenized output, and but your own perspective on all of these issues that are addressed by this.
Yeah, so I'm definitely kind of like a dualist. I'll start off with that. So I think you're going to see both right now. Like, we're going to see, you know, people that are kind of going around the same idea and they keep reiterating that same idea and it's not really creating anything new. And then I see other people that are going to take the current ideas and then advance them in places that we haven't like actually ever seen before. So I see both happening. And kind of to Alex's point around, you know, if the goal is strictly just on like, you know, consumption, some consumption behaviors don't actually require or want creativity. They actually just want like programming, you know, like very, very like stuff that is just kind of dished out to them in a predictable fashion. And it just, you know, it feeds them and they want it. And then other people crave a creative that actually is not just a passive consumption exercise, but rather one that is like an active consumption exercise where there's like this thought behind it. So I think what you're going to see is that some of this AI generated content is going to appeal to both. We're going to see, you know, major increase in people getting access to passive consumption. And then that could be, you know, in my opinion, not the greatest use of the technology. And then I think you'll see other people use the same tools, same techniques, but then they'll be making content that actually requires people to like to be critically thinking and engaging with the stories beyond just passively consuming. So I don't know, I'm conflicted because I similar to, you know what I'm hearing, what Aya and Alex were saying, you know, like, especially when you do audience testing and you find that people on average want the same thing over and over again, but then individually they want custom things to cater to them. I see AI tools achieving both. You can use it to make the same thing over and over again on repeat with just like a little variation here. And then you can, and I also see it doing the other way of like iterating on an idea that has never been done before, you know, bringing two concepts together that have never been shared together on screen and coming up with inventive. I don't know, I'm conflicted. I love Alex and Aya's statements, but now after hearing Alex, I'm conflicted with my own views now, which is great. I need to think about this.
Well, there's a lot to think about. And Mike, I do want to get into the landscape, but I want to continue on this kind of, the real world of what it means for artists, such as an Alex and his example of writing scores, because yeah. We know what AI can do, like he was laying out. And so the questions of threats, this is putting it all in a pejorative light, and that's not my intent, but it's, I also want to address the real world issues from artists and from creativity in general that Alex touched upon. So everybody's perspectives on, does AI devalue human art by the sheer mass of it all? That's kind of one question. And is there a real threat to jobs out there in the creative community? Because there's a lot of people who are going to be watching this who are in the entertainment creative community business. And that could be marketers who are creating graphic art. It could be, you know, all of us. Mike writes, I write. We all do creative things. So I would love for you, you had a discussion of this devaluation at AILA. And I'd love to get some of your thoughts there on that, about just the real world implications.
Oh, for me.
Yeah, why don't you start us off and then go to Aya again. And Alex, I want to come back to you, and then we'll get into some more of the legal framework of where things are right now in terms of copyright and where they're going.
Yeah, so I use that word devalue, and I know it's a very triggering word, but what I'm specifically saying is, like, for me, the value of creativity is like endless, but like the value of like monetary is finite. So what I mean by that is, if everyone is able to generate, like, I'm going to put this in air quotes, high quality AI driven art content, and that could be music, that could be videos, images, voices, performances, et cetera. It will make the cost of those things, if they're only represented as digital assets, it will reduce the quality, it will devalue, you know, the purpose of that. But I think simultaneously, it would increase the value of things that are more tangible, like physical things. A point that I made in the AI LA conversation was around that sci-fi book that I read, and I would encourage other people to read, by Neal Stephenson, The Diamond Age. And what they talk about in that science fiction book was, they have this technology, there's 3D printers in this sci-fi future, they could print anything on demand, basically from a text prompt. So it made the cost of materials very low. But then what people seem to value in this example was, they valued stuff that was like handmade. They loved, like, the elite and the rich in this sci-fi novel loved their handcrafted things, because they were truly unique. The machine couldn't have made it. So they were valuable because of that, and it was hard to replicate. But then if things are very, very easy to replicate, and if people just want to consume it, then they're not going to be willing or as interested in to paying for it when they can very easily distribute it. It's kind of like how the cost of film and physical photos are much more expensive now than like the interest in using them. They're valuable because now we can generate images on the fly with our phones. Like, because we've kind of digitized photo taking, we kind of don't value, monetarily speaking, photography as much anymore, like the physical form of it.
Okay, so just really practical, do you believe that AI threatens a wide swath of jobs in the entertainment industry?
Yes, all of them.
Okay, all of them. So what does it mean for an Alex as a creator? As he said, he was, and I'm going to ask you this question. So what does it mean to somebody who's writing scores, writing songs, and there's all these, you know, endless outputs that may be homogenized to a certain extent, but to Alex's point, sure, if that's what our ears know. So do you feel like AI is a threat to wide swaths of the entertainment industry? And that's, it can be not just an Alex type creator, but, you know, all of us. I'll ask Aya on that one.
Yeah, please.
Not so trying to put you on the spot, but these are questions that we have to grapple with.
No, definitely. I think they're valid questions. And again, like even as a data scientist, I feel like a lot of times people think we're coming in and like what we're building is going to replace people's jobs. And my thoughts are more of kind of like the calculator and like coding and like computers, like you have to adapt. So I think that it is important as we see that there's a new technology that is easily, like even as data scientists, like I did have a second to think like, oh wait, because ChatGPT can code, like am I gonna be replaced? But really it can spit out garbage code. Like it can spit out garbage content. Like it's still created by humans. And so it's really the human input. And I think it's important to understand how to utilize like AI to like make your job better and faster. And I think that to an extent, you know, writing an entire song and having AI create that, like that's very different than AI being your assistant to help you get all the admin stuff so you have that mental state to create the art. I think especially around the origin, that's going to be really like important, because even as like, you know, I would say like, you know, consider myself an AI artist, I would never, like I wasn't in like PFPs, in like NFTs, like I didn't make like multiple, like I've always made one-on-ones, and there's always a very like meticulous process to how I create my work. And I think that people are going to want to understand how things are created more to really put the value to it.
Do you believe that sometimes I use this analogy of manufacturing being upended by robotics coming in, and how it there was tremendous displacement of jobs. It created new jobs because any new technology comes in and threatens existing states of play. But typically, you know, you saw, and I use this one too, where like Disney, Pixar came in. And it was this, you know, computer generated animation, and some who are more on the, I guess, positive side of AI's impact would say that it took away, like the computer generated animation took away some of the mundane aspects of hand drawing frame by frame when it came to animation. So it enabled creators to focus more on the story itself. And I'm just like, do you believe is that the way you think about it? Kind of along those lines?
Exactly how I think about it. I think you said it really well in terms of just, again, using AI in order, like if it's doing something that's repetitive, like you probably should be thinking AI, like you probably shouldn't do that. So you have more time to be more, you know, effective. And this is like I keep making the State Department connection because I think they're very similar, but I had a client who, she was basically the assistant secretary to the assistant secretary. And every day she would review like line by line the data because she didn't trust the data. And we basically took time to like understand her work process and like pointed out like, these are different ways that we can design something so that we can free up your time to be more effective. And she was actually really excited. So I think, you know, AI needs to be regulated. Like I think, you know, people having their art stolen is never going to be okay. But again, understanding how AI can help you be co-creative and more productive, I think is like where we should lean into.
So Alex, I want to go back to you and then we'll go over to Mike and just kind of the states of play and how some of Mike's clients are struggling with things too. But Alex, so we are faced, first of all, as I was telling everybody at the beginning, Alex is not only this, you know, brilliant musician, but also very deeply knowledgeable about technology. So not afraid of technology. You know, Alex is not that kind of guy at all, but he laid out with passion, which I completely understand, you know, the threats to what he's doing and his view of art and how AI leads to this kind of more, you know, vanilla-ish kind of outputs, right, over time. And so Alex, as an artist, this is the reality. You know, we can't walk away from it because it's here to stay. So how do you feel about it on a going forward basis? Not just the, you know, the concerns, but will you change the way you do what you do? And that can mean from your craft alone, but also just learning more about it. Like, just what is your advice to yourself, but advice to other artists out there?
Man, there's so much I want to respond to. I want to just highlight that we're talking about artificial intelligence. That's what AI stands for. So when we talk about a calculator or new graphic software that can help us animate, none of that is artificial intelligence. Artificial intelligence is here to replace our need for intelligence. Now we have artificial intelligence. I can outsource my intelligence to artificial operations. I was on a panel once and a kid raised his hand. It was about music. And he said, "You know how hard it is to produce?" And I was like, "Yeah." He's like, "You know, using Apple Loops and figuring out how to use Apple Loops." Now, Apple Loops are a plug and play sound package where you just like put in a drum sound and it creates a beat. That's what he was saying, was like, you know. Now, the problem with something like Apple Loops, talk about homogenization. The snare is hitting at the same velocity every single time. Now, it's not even a snare that you recorded. It's pre-recorded, it's pre-produced, pre-compressed. Everything about it is happening in almost identical repetition. Our know-how, our techne, is disappearing. And that's okay. I'm not saying it's not okay, but what kind of experience do we want to have as humans on Earth? We do get to decide. It's not totally inevitable. I mean, I realize that we're totally compulsive beings. And if we said the world was going to end tomorrow unless you all stop innovating for 1 week, like, we wouldn't be able to do it. We have some kind of like death drive compulsion towards singularity, right? It's very fascinating in and of itself. But anyway, I wanted to touch on what some of you were saying. I think Don was saying something about, I think, and this comes back to the question you just asked me. I think my advice to people who are interested in still having an experience of constraints. So the thing that I'd like to bring up is like where AI is going to be interesting, and this is like a Brian Eno quote, although he doesn't reference AI, is where it breaks. Where are the thresholds, the limitations beyond which it begins to fall apart? Because that's why distortion became interesting. That's why, right, you know, constraints are how originality occurs, limitations. So like, where are the limitations of AI? And when we find the limitations of AI, AI might become interesting. The only cool things I've seen AI spit out so far are the AI fails, where it can't do fingers and it makes all these weird images, and where GPT chat is like spitting out nonsense that's just not true. There's a great article about why GPT chat lies so much. And actually it has to do with the fact that GPT chat is organized to please us with its outputs. So it's constantly lying and spitting out sort of non-factual information. But anyway, so what I would say is that, you know, this is what Don's point was. We do have an affinity still for the idea of like tangible origins. If we see something artisanal and we're like, oh, that was made by hand and it's a one of a kind and it makes me feel special because it's special. But in order for that to happen, you have to have a sense of a tangible origin. And yet we're so beguiled by imitations of tangible origins, right? So we'll buy the pre-ripped gene. We'll buy an experience of struggle. Like, struggle is commodifiable, right? And we have all these experiences where like we're buying the thing at Urban Outfitter that looks like it's from Peru and made by hand, but it's mass produced to look like it's from Peru. So we're very gullible for these things because they're so easy. So what my suggestion is like, the more that AI becomes the mainstream, the more the cachet will move from AI to the handmade stuff, and there will be a niche on the outside of, yeah, but it's going to be this sort of asymmetrical cachet. And and so that's what I'm looking forward to, is actually sort of, you know, raising the flag of humanity outside of the paradigm of AI. And honestly, I'm not very interested in using AI, nor am I really interested in using Apple Loops. Every time I do that, it's honestly not that much fun to produce music. It's quicker, I'm more productive, but it's not as interesting for me. I don't reach interesting limitations. I don't end up with an interesting sound that you could never recreate because of the reflections in the given room and the way the velocity and the thing, and I'm hitting, you know, these constraints are important. These failures are important. So it's in two things I just wanted to highlight. One, where are the constraints and failures of AI? That'll be interesting. And two, to forge your own path apart from it.
By the way, on that point, because I just wrote a piece about it, actually, about the humanity that can never be matched by AI. And I was actually quoting Rick Rubin, and if you know, super producer Rick Rubin, he has a new book about creativity. And it's not just about creativity in music, it's about creativity in everything. But he was saying that he knows, or he works with artists, and they know when something is perfect to them or to their art, not when it has five mistakes, but when it has eight mistakes. And it was just a fascinating quote, but I urge everybody for you to check out Malcolm Gladwell's podcast interview of Rick Rubin, because it gets into all these kinds of issues. But Mike, I want to turn it over to you, because we've heard all of this, which is context, critical context. And you deal with this kind of on the front lines of, okay, there's all this scraping, the training of the artificial intelligence by the existing works that are out there. Let's talk about what the state of play is in the legal landscape today, and then maybe some possible solutions as best they can, and then we'll get into Q&A.
Sure. First of all, before I get into the legal, I just think it's, and I'm not the front line, I'm kind of the back line. The rest of y'all are the front line, because I think the reason that we're all here is we all recognize how disruptive and exciting and scary this is, not only to, you know, creators, but basically any job. And I think it really pushes us to think about what it means to be human and what intelligence is, just the way other advances in technology have. And I think, you know, when we think about the law, you know, ideally the law is thinking about that as a policy, right? When we get into copyright, like how do we protect and incent innovation, and, you know, what is infringement? And so I think that's the backbone for everything. I do want to get into the legal side a little bit, but I also wanted to say that I think I just set a new land speed record for lawyers not speaking. I think I went about 40 minutes. So you can all say you were here for that. But you know, on the legal side, I think there are kind of like three areas that we're looking at. One is kind of what's happening at the Copyright Office. You know, when you use AI to create a work, or, you know, whether it's AI created, whatever that means, or AI assisted, should I be able to get a copyright on it? If it creates an invention, should I be able to get a patent on it? And when I first started looking at this, I thought this was kind of like a cute issue, like, oh yeah, like the robot can be an inventor. But the more I thought about it, the more it's actually quite an important issue, because if we are using these tools and we are creating stuff, and I think folks have said, like, what are you really doing when you're a prompt? Like, you know, when I prompt, you know, one of these apps to create art, am I really doing a creative act such that I have the rights to that? And I think, you know, the implication, if you can't protect this with our current IP laws, and of course, you know, those can change, is it becomes public domain. If there are businesses that are using these things and we're really using it for creative output, you know, protecting it under our existing IP laws is kind of important. So there's the Copyright Office and what's happening there, and I can talk a little bit. Then there's been a handful of litigations that have been filed, like three or four just in the past months, against some of these AI apps like Stability AI and Midjourney, basically asserting either copyright infringement or trademark infringement, or focusing on this scraping of data sets, because all these AI apps rely on training from really large swaths of data. So sites like Getty Images that have millions and millions of photos that this AI will then crawl through and then spit out something. You know, Getty is saying, hey, wait a minute. You know, I want to license that to you. I want to give you permission to you. I don't want to just take it. And the artists that have contributed their work to Getty or who haven't are also saying, hey, wait a minute, that's my art and you're creating something from it. So those are kind of, that's kind of the landscape, you know, and currently, you know, at the patent office, at the Copyright Office, I should say, you know, currently the position is, there've been a couple things going on, is that a purely AI created work is not eligible for copyright or patent protection. There's currently a case where this this British doctor is challenging that. It's currently, he's saying that, you know, if you look at the Constitution and you look at the Copyright Act, it's not limited to humans. So that case is churning its way through. But, you know, so far the Copyright Office is saying if it's AI created, you can't register a copyright for it. The difficult question is, what about AI assisted? And the Copyright Office, I think just today, I saw a reference that they're going to be putting out some guidance on this, which I think will be welcome.
Oh, wow.
But yeah, but like, but so using this as a tool, you know, there was a woman who created a graphic novel called Zarya of the Dawn, where she created the chapters and the story and the arc, and then she used AI to create the images and registered the images, and the Copyright Office registered it, and she went out and said, hey, I got the first registration for an AI-assisted work. The Copyright Office has since backtracked, and they're going to now to cancel that. So where that line is between AI-assisted and AI-created, I think is still pretty up in the air, and it's kind of an interesting issue. In terms of the courts and stuff, these litigations that have been filed, there are a couple. One is a class action lawsuit brought by a set of artists against Stability AI, basically saying, like, look, what ChatGPT is or what Stability AI is basically like a pastiche kind of tool. It copies existing stuff and mashes them together. And that focuses on the ability to produce for some of these apps art in the style of an artist, right? Like, I want to produce art in the style of Picasso or a modern day artist. And so that's the focus. So they've said in that suit, well, that's copyright infringement. You know, you're copying, those are derivative works. And I think, you know, those lawsuits, it's really unclear. I think those lawsuits kind of face a tall uphill battle, because it's not clear to me that there's actual copying going on. There's a data set that exists that it trains on. It's also not clear to me, you know, a defense that often comes up in copyright infringement is transformative use, fair use. Like, I'm not copying it, I'm taking it and creating something new with it, and I should be allowed to do that. There's a Supreme Court, a non-AI, just straight up art Supreme Court case now involving Andy Warhol, who has this, who made kind of one of those Andy Warhol, you know, quad prints with a photo of Prince, the guitarist. And the question is, did he transform it or is it just copyright infringement? So I think that suit is hard. There's another suit that Getty brought that says it's also trademark infringement. Those suits are at the very beginning, and it's going to be tough. It'll be interesting to see like how they shake out. But it's far from clear that existing copyright or trademark laws are going to, you know, be slam dunk wins against these AI apps. Just one last point is that I think it's interesting, like, these apps can be used in, you know, infringing, or they can be used obviously for lots of things, right? Write code, create movies, you know, give me the answer to this, do search. So what's interesting, I think, is I think it's a different story when maybe a user says, hey, I'm going to use this in an infringing way. Like, if I, through my prompt, say, hey, I want to make art that looks just like Don Allen Stevenson's piece, and here it is. You know, that I could see would be a more straightforward kind of copyright issue, where it's not the app is definitively problematic, but the way it's used.
But by the way, and then Don, I think you were chiming in, but, you know, the reality of all this too is that when Mike talks about the legal landscape and there's all these cases that are out there and struggling with it, remember, these are across the country, but it's also across the world. You have all
There's one in the UK on Getty on the data scraping. So yeah, it's worldwide.
And the dirty little secret about the legal profession and the courts is, like, I was a federal law clerk in my first job. I was this kid fresh out of law school making decisions that impacted people's lives. And so it's not like just because we put on the robes or the judges put on the robes and you have juries that there's a right answer here. So that's why, like, tracking everything that Mike is saying is so critical for everybody, including Alex and Aya and Don and everybody who's out there, is because there is going to be this pastiche of results. And ultimately, what is the right result? You know, what is the wrong result? There is no answer to these things, but society is going to have to try to find a way to put some guard articles on this. So I do want to get into solutions, potential solutions, but Don, go ahead.
Yeah, the comment I had early for you, Peter, and everybody was like, you asked, like, what can people actually do right now, like for artists in general, and also for legally? I think what's going to happen is people are going to care less about the final output, like, because anyone can fake it. They're going to really start caring about how it was made. So the artists that can document their process, show what creative human-made decisions were made and how they made this, what was the intentionality, what was the heart. And if there was a legal structure that could kind of look at that when judging on the AI output, like how much, you know, how much work, how much human level work went into that AI generated thing. And if the answer is like below some threshold, then that's not okay. But if it's above some threshold that's decided by people, then it is okay. Just a thought, because like very practically, I've been encouraging people to live stream and document and record voice memos and have people interview you as you're making whatever art form you're making, and then have that be a part of the art piece, have that be the story. I feel like humans are very narrative based beings. We love story. So like, if you don't have a story that shows that you put human level love, energy, and heart into that thing, then it's just an AI generated automation, homogenous nonsense. But if it's like, whoa, this person put a lot of actual blood, sweat, and tears, and we can measure that, we can see that, we can record that, then maybe it might, you know, I just wanted to put that out there because I didn't offer a good solution earlier, but I was thinking that one might be one potential one.
That's a great point. That's a great point about connection, I think, and connecting through art and the process. I think it's a great idea. And the other point I wanted to make, aside from the IP law stuff, and someone mentioned it, but regulations, you know, are we going to have regulations or technologies that help us to identify when something is AI created versus not? There are other countries like, you know, China is being really aggressive about rolling out AI and putting out regulations like that. And I think in dealing with some of these, you know, larger than law cultural issues, you know, those types of regulations, I think, become really important.
Yeah. And the breadcrumbs that you were talking about, Don, it was one of the words that you're using a lot. And I was using a lot at the panel and everybody at the panel, which is the concept of provenance, you know, which helps. So provenance is the, you know, the aspects that were from you, by you, the creator, that ultimately resulted in the creative output. And so capturing that, if there are ways for the legal system or whatever, all systems, to be able to measure the provenance, and that will help define that there is real human creativity behind this thing, and that some sector of society will value the fact. You know, this gets to your point, Alex, that we'll get to that will appreciate the blood, sweat, and tears and humanity behind it. That will, I believe, like, you know, I believe that there's something to the human soul that has a unique connection that an AI can't match. And that gets into things like the fallibility of it. One of the examples you used, Alex, that I thought was great, was the drum machine, and how, you know, you have this looped drum, the snare drum, that's perfect. You know, it's perfect, perfect, perfect. And so it keeps the beat perfectly. But no matter how good a drummer is, an actual human drummer, it's never going to be perfect. And that leads to that imperfection, leads to a different kind of sound that may have it will have a different kind of connection to at least a certain audience that's out there. So I think that all of those pieces are interesting. And on the solution front, I want to just lay out one thing that I was thinking of, because I was trying to, you know, as I was doing my writing about this, and how can we even, you know, start thinking about copyright infringement from a practical standpoint? Like, how can that be measured? So that we know all the different, you know, everything that was scraped that came into the outcome, the output. Well, one of the things that when I was at the AILA event, I saw a company, and I was talking to the founder behind a company called Lore Machine, L-O-R-E Machine. And I thought they had an interesting approach where right now they're creating graphic novels, AI generated graphic novels. And the way they work is that they partner with artists who want to be in the pool of, you know, from which the quote unquote scraping or the training is done, and there's a pay, so they opt in to this system. And so the output is based on the opt-in works that have been training the system. And then there's a monetization aspect to all the artists who are within that pool. And I thought that was interesting. I thought the opt-in nature and then artists like an opt-out, opt-in. I know there's a lot of those concepts that are kind of floating around out there, you know, how practical that's going to be. But I do think that the lore machine approach is a nice direction. At least, you know, one trying to be a solution out there. So I know we don't have much time. We have a few minutes and there's a lot of questions in the side and I haven't even looked at them. But first of all, those who are watching, you see there's feedback from Alex and Mike. And I think all the panelists have some comments and also pointing you to different articles and posts. And so I urge you to take a look at those. But if anybody has, I want to open it up first to the panelists, because I want to make sure everybody had a chance to convey the a critical aspect that they wanted to convey. So Aya, is there anything else that you'd like to bring up before we get into the questions?
Thanks for asking. Thinking about it, I think one thing I would just want to add on is, Alex, you made a point of how AI is artificial intelligence and it's replacing intelligence. I think that's like a strong definition of someone who does this daily, because it's not necessarily, like, at least in some cases, maybe that is a case, but I wouldn't say that's like an absolute definition of everything that AI does is so that we don't think and we completely take their intelligence. I think with the example that you shared in terms of like the graphic novel and having a bunch of artists co-creating with AI is a good example of that. Of building upon and building something together versus just having a black box. And that's when I say, like, I think a black box is a good example of that, where you have no idea what's happening. It's like, model gave this to me, I'm gonna trust it. And that's not the approach that I'm suggesting. It's more of a very collaborative, co-creative approach.
So I wanna, because I'm looking through and I'm trying to do my best I can to raise some of these points that are made by people. So I'm going to just read a couple of them that I find, because they're less questions than comments. And so in no particular order, Nicholas, thanks for joining. So he says, honestly, thank God Alex is here and not laying out threats to himself. None of us take that personally, but it's great to hear this. Not laying out threats to himself and his art, but to all of us as feeling living beings. So it's the humanist thing. From my perspective, it seems that the productivity fetishists don't see the bigger picture as their eyes are on a different kind of prize. I hear tired metaphors like the calculator regarding how AI will affect certain jobs, but not much about the larger implications on the experience of being humans on Earth. And there's plenty of conversation about what AI is now, but very little foresight about what it will be in just a few years or less. I mean, that's a very big issue. And I think it's worth tackling a little bit where, I'll give my perspective. I have no idea how I feel about it, quite frankly. I feel about it like it's here. I can't put my head in the sand. I write, I do a lot of writing. I put a lot of time into it, You know, I think I'm pretty good at it. I put it out there and there's no question that I absolutely believe a lot of jobs will be lost. I think that there is, I want to believe, as I conveyed, that there's something about humanity that no matter how sophisticated AI gets, that will be appreciated and that will be differentiated. But you know, that's the only perspective I have, that we all have to just be very stoic about the fact that this is happening. And so we convey the humanist aspects of it and don't forget that at the same time, we need to like stay on top of the developments that are happening and find ways as best we can to leverage the technology without losing our souls. That's my perspective. So Alex, why don't you give a little bit, I want everybody to get a chance to chime in here before we end.
I don't want to end on the most pessimistic note, but I think that I'm headed that way, just because of what Aya said, and I wanted to respond to that. I agree, and also what you had mentioned about the comment that said, you know, we're at the beginning of this, and so to judge it as, hey, look, it's all good,
you know, is to sort of put on the blinders and to consider how much this is going to develop and take things over. There's a concept that's worth understanding. It has a fancy name. It's called a multipolar trap. But basically, it's like a game theoretic idea where, like, Aya uses it this way that she's saying, and yes, it helps her with code, but she's still putting in her input. But her competitor starts relying on it more, and it starts increasing her competitor's productivity to the point where her competitor is now getting all her jobs. So now what does Aya do? Well, now Aya has to do the same thing. And then so it's this idea of, like, you have a resource and everyone agrees only to take a cup of water from the pool, but all you need is one bad actor to start taking two or three cups a day. And then all of a sudden, everyone, it's a race to the bottom. And productivity is the centerpiece of capitalism. And so I don't buy the argument that we're going to sort of keep it at arm's distance and just kind of utilize it when necessary. It's going to provide such an upper hand that even if you don't want to use it, you're going to sort of be forced into using it, especially at the level of the coder and those sort of productivity measurements are, where those productivity measurements are so integral to the hiring process. Anyway, I'll just leave it at that. And that's a very sour note, but this has been very fun. And
But Alex, I don't think any of us should feel like it's a sour note or whatever. This is, we feel what we feel.
I would love to believe that we would all have the fortitude to keep things and to really appreciate. But, you know, one thing that we haven't, I don't even think the words come up, but capitalism has a major impact on our behavior, you know, and it forces, all we need is one bad actor, not even a bad actor, one person to be like, you know what, I'm going to use this more and it's working more. And then in 5 years, you know what, the code is so damn good. Like, how can I not use it? And then pretty soon we're just sort of removed from the creative process, and that will reach its own limitation. And there might be very interesting, you know, things that occur after that. And that becomes sort of an equilibrium from which we have new expressions of creativity that we can't even imagine. Absolutely possible. Or we just turn into bots and we're totally eradicated from the earth. And we have no purpose.
Yes. What if it's both?
Yeah. Well, yes, there will be a subculture that I would love to be a part of that will be refusing that, if that's what you mean by both. But otherwise, I don't know what you mean by both.
Well, off-grid living. Like, I can imagine people completely opposed to me, say, you know what, I'm opting out of capitalism. Fuck that. I'm out. Isn't that also just possible?
Of course, and that'll be great, but it won't be the, you know, it'll be an asymmetrical sort of social structure, and it'll be the few, but it'll be cool for that reason, and it'll be interesting, and everything's probably going to be fine, everybody, but my point stands.
That's a fantastic point.
I love that. Everything will probably be fine.
Yeah.
Don, I think you, we're at the hour, and I said that I was going to keep it at the hour. I have to cut it off just because I want to keep it at the hour. But this conversation is so fascinating, and I want to thank Alex, obviously. You know, Alex, you know how much I respect you and your perspective on everything. Aya, I really respect your opinions on everything, and was really impressed with you when I saw you at AILA, and I continue to be impressed. So thanks for joining me. Don, similarly, apart from the cat, which I thought was amazing, thanks for bringing your great perspectives too. I want to continue the dialogue with all of you. And then, of course, my partner in crime on the other coast, Mike Kasdan, who's deeply versed in these issues. And we banter back and forth all the time about them, like, you know, where's this going? How do we track this? I learn a lot from him and his perspectives.
Likewise.
And so, Mike, thanks for, you know, for co-hosting this and making it all happen. Let's continue the conversation. And for everybody out there, if you're interested in learning more, reach out to Mike. I think you have his information. If you're interested in reaching out to me and you have my information, you know, I'm at Creative Media. You can just find me, Peter, at creativemedia.biz. Mike, I think your information is on there, but why don't you lay it out? And then if somebody wants to ask a question of Alex or Aya or Don, just send them to me and I'll filter through them. And I want everybody's perspectives too. So Mike, your contact information too.
Yeah, sounds great. I'm pretty easy to find on all the social media places, LinkedIn or Twitter. But if you want to email me, I just threw it in the chat. It's mkasdan@wigan. And yeah, thanks everyone to the panelists for sharing their time and their views and spending the hour with us. And thanks everyone for coming.
Thanks everybody. Appreciate it. Thanks panel.
Thank you.
You guys were great.